Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism.
The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we enhance your brain with weird and wonderful science. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this special edition, we look back to the man who wanted to augment human intelligence to help us work together to solve the world's most complex problems. And in doing so, invented the networking revolution. The man who invented the 21st century, Douglas Engelbart. Augmenting human intelligence. How do we get smart enough to solve the really difficult problems we have in the world? Douglas Engelbart said, the better we get at getting better, the faster we will get better. Douglas Engelbart, computer pioneer and visionary, should be famous for his 1968 Mother of All Demos, where he filmed a TED Talk-style live demonstration of what has become modern computing and the internet, to an audience of 2,000 people. Unfortunately, hardly anyone has heard of him. At the time, computers were not interactive. You fed the computer with cardboard cards or paper tape punched with holes that represented your data or software code. You had to come back a few days later to get punch cards or paper punch tape of results, and then another computer could use those to print numerical results. Douglas Engelbart demonstrated computers with screens, keyboards and mouses, text editing with cut and paste, shared documents over networks, video conferencing over networks, all in 1968. He didn't just come up with these innovations at random, he was trying to solve a particular problem, augmenting human intelligence. In 1951, at the age of 25, Douglas Engelbart began to reconsider the purpose of his life. He'd experienced World War II as a radar technician. And, like lots of scientists and engineers who experienced war, Engelbart decided to redirect his post-war efforts towards peaceful ends, to maximise his contribution to mankind. Engelbart eventually recognised that the electronic computer, invented during the war to calculate artillery firing tables and atomic bomb yields and decrypt secrets, could be repurposed as a tool for solving the many difficult problems of the post-war world, and the radar screen could be repurposed as a display for the computer. In an interview decades later with Wired magazine, he told the story of his 1951 realization. All of a sudden, wham, I got an image of myself sitting at a big cathode ray tube screen with all kinds of symbols on it. New and different ones, manipulated by a computer that could be operated through various input devices. All of the material on the screen could be controlled with great flexibility. Other people had their display units tied to the same computer complex, and you could connect them. Everybody could share knowledge. The vision unfolded rapidly in about half an hour, and suddenly the potential of interactive, collaborative computing became totally clear. Douglas Engelbart wrote a paper in 1962 entitled Augmenting Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework. He proposed that human progress could be accelerated by augmenting our intellectual capabilities through the use of computers to work together more effectively. He saw a symbiotic relationship between humans and technology, where computers would act as powerful tools to amplify human intelligence, creativity, and problem-solving abilities through our collective intelligence. His vision for augmenting human intelligence included collective intelligence. Engelbart emphasized the importance of collaboration and collective problem-solving. He envisioned a networked environment where individuals could work together using shared information tools, fostering collaboration and collective intelligence. Interactive computing. Engelbart recognized the need for intuitive and interactive computer interfaces that would enable users to interact with computers in a natural and efficient manner. Information retrieval and knowledge organization. He recognized the growing challenge of information overload. He proposed systems for organising and retrieving information efficiently, enabling users to access relevant knowledge quickly and effectively. Continuous improvement. Engelbart believed in an iterative process of improvement and refinement leading to more improvement and refinement. He envisioned a cycle of feedback and learning where users would continuously refine and enhance their tools and methods based on their experiences and insights. You use tools to develop a different way of thinking, to develop new tools which change the way you make the next generation of better tools, and so on. He called it a bootstrapping approach. He argued that users would gain in expertise and sophistication as they adopted new cutting-edge computing technologies. The result would be iterative co-evolution of both users and computers. Douglas Engelbart's most significant project that embodied these ideas was the Augmentation Research Center, which he founded in 1963 at the Stanford Research Institute. The Augmentation Research Center aimed to develop technologies and systems that would augment human intellect. His team designed and tested different selection tools to manipulate the on-screen symbols and text, including a light pen, a joystick, and a rollerball controlled by the user's knee. His invention of the mouse came out of turning the rollerball upside down and mounting buttons on the top. He got the idea of using a cathode ray tube as a display screen from working as a radar technician, seeing radar displayed on a screen. He developed a 5-key cording keyboard so that people could type without taking their hands off the mouse and without looking at their hands, but it's not really been taken up because it was hard to commercialise. The Augmentation Research Center team spent months assembling a custom infrastructure so that Engelbart could stand on stage in San Francisco and demonstrate the capabilities of the online system, NLS, which was 48 kilometers or 30 miles away, in Menlo Park. They placed cameras in front of two monitors at Stanford Research Institute, erected receiver dishes at the auditorium in San Francisco, and beamed two channels of video along a microwave link. Two more cameras in the auditorium captured Engelbart's face and hands as they manipulated the keyboard, mouse, and cord keyset. Finally, the team rigged up a homemade 2400 bits per second modem to transmit commands from Engelbart's console in San Francisco back to Menlo Park over a leased telephone line. The team used a 4-channel video controller to direct what was projected on the auditorium's 20-foot, 7-meter screen. He could split the screen and show Engelbart's face alongside his computer screen. Altogether, 7 researchers contributed to the demo. The video, projector, and screen were loaned from NASA. The audience could follow his actions on his display, observe how he used his mouse, and watch as members of the team joined in the presentation. The overarching theme of the demo was the potential for technology to enhance human cognitive abilities and enable people to work together more effectively, emphasising the importance of collaboration, information sharing, and knowledge management. Engelbart began with a provocative question.
If in your office, you as an intellectual worker were supplied with a computer display backed up by a computer that was alive for you all day, instantly responsive to every action you had, how much value could you derive from that?
He then put the NLS through its paces. He opened a new document and typed word, 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 word on the screen. If I make some mistakes, I can backspace a bit, as he demonstrated the delete function. Then he showed how he could copy and paste blocks of text or drag and drop items to reorder them. He showed off the system's graphical user interface by pulling up a map of his route home from work, with planned stops at the grocery store, the drugstore, and the library. Library, what am I supposed to do there? He asked. Clicking on the word library, a hypertext link pulled up another list. Overdue books. He returned to the map and clicked on the drugstore link. It led to another list with items like aspirin and chapstick. Then via teleconference, Engelbart and his researcher Don Andrews described the operations of the cord keyset and the mouse. Two other research then conferenced to Bill Paxton in Menlo Park to describe how two users could collaboratively edit the same document.
I'd like to have him see my text. And so this special thing, if I label 13, will switch over. So in his display, he sees my text. So I'll execute it. And sure enough, it does. But what's that running around? Well, if he's looking at my text, he'd like to have something to say about it. So we put on a marker, a tracking spot that he controls. So he's sitting there in Menlo Park looking at this text, and he can point to it. But we've carefully reserved for me the right to control and operate on this. So my bug is more powerful than yours. But we can have an argument. Yeah. That's what they call a bug fight. We've set up now audio coupling, and then we're both looking at the same display, and that'd be very handy to work. We can talk to each other and point, and maybe later I can hand you the chalk on this blackboard, like saying, here, you control it. But let's stay this mode now and add another feature that hardware-wise is available to the kind of display we have.
Then he demonstrated video conferencing while sharing a workspace.
I'd like to see you while I'm working on it. So before I can do that, I have to set up my display in a certain way. Set it up so I see it over like that. That leaves a corner up there, and I say, now, computer, do the automatic switching that'll bring in a camera picture from the camera mounted on his console, such as the camera mounted on mine is. Hi, Bill. That's great. Now we're connected audio. You can see my work. You can point at it, and I can see your face, and we can talk. So let's do some collaborating. You're silent.
Oh. What do you want me to say?
Yeah. There's nobody here but a large audience, Bill.
All right.
Finally, in a bit of tantalizing foreshadowing, Engelbart described how Stanford Research International was poised in 1969 to become the second node of a new communications network called ARPANET, which, of course, was the precursor to the modern Internet.
And our forthcoming involvement is this ARPA computer network, the experimental network that's going to come into being in its first form in about a year and end up sometime later with some 20 experimental computers in a network. And they hope to be able to transmit across the country with bandwidths of something like 20 kilobits per second, delay times of less than a tenth of a second, which would be enough so that I could be running a system in Cambridge over the network and getting the same kind of response on a CRT. And it may be that people there, yeah, the next time we have a conference in Boston, I'll try this from there.
You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com.
Only a year later, he followed up with a sequel demo, not only showing off the technology, but showing how they'd use the technology to change the way they worked to make new improvements and innovations more quickly. The 1969 demonstration showed Douglas Engelbart with four co-presenters video conferenced in from the lab at Stanford Research Institute, 35 miles away. Production and logistics were supported by a 24-person team back at the lab. You can watch both the 1968 and the 1969 demos at the Douglas Engelbart Institute, who also have interactive videos of both of these events, where you can click on different things and get different bits of information. Around that time, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, was gearing its ARPANET initiative to make the large computational mainframe computer resources available remotely to the ARPA research community. The beginnings of the internet. Engelbart was thrilled about the potential for their NLS Collaborative Hyperlinks text editor to be accessed over the net to support communities of knowledge workers, and was given funds to set up the ARPANET Network Information Center, NIC, to support the ARPANET community.
The ARPANET idea was basically established to share computational resources. Then they all got sort of smart about it, and they turned to Larry and Bob and said, well, who's going to keep a real, index, et cetera, a catalog of all the resources? So if we want to use certain kind of computational resources, we know which computer out there and how to get it from that. And they hadn't thought of that. So for me sitting there, I'd been talking with a group about how are we ever going to get a community going, which is what you're going to have to do to make this work. And there it was, it's going to be a community. So I volunteered to start and operate a network information center that would deal with that. And so that they everybody was relieved. So that's why they tied our computer on as the second one. So that's an interesting history of all the internet now. We got there as early as you can get on a network.
He set to work extending NLS for community support, including integrated hypertext email and an automated library facility, The Journal. By 1978, there were 5 to 6 mainframes running NLS to support a variety of user communities. In 1970, Engelbart's technology was licensed by the Stanford Research Institute to Xerox, who were a laser printer manufacturer, and some of his team of researchers decided to move to Xerox with the licensing. These researchers were excited at the idea of personal computers, and they couldn't understand the value of Douglas Engelbart's ideas of social networking, network computers, and online communities. At Xerox, they worked on making the mouse, graphical user interface, and word processing useful to Xerox staff internally, so they would have an edge over their competitors. They had no intention of selling any computers. Steve Jobs was invited in to see what they'd achieved, and Xerox sold him the rights to use their software for $1 million of Apple shares. Apple licensed the mouse directly from Stanford Research Institute for just $40,000. Douglas Engelbart never received any royalties for the invention of the mouse. Apple went on to sell the Lisa as the first personal computer with a mouse and a graphical user interface in 1983, with the Macintosh being sold in 1984, X-Windows for Unix in 1984, and Microsoft Windows 1.0 in 1985. Steve Jobs was worried the government could spy on people over the internet, so he banned networking from Apple computers. Steve Jobs demonstrated the first Macintosh to Douglas Engelbart. Here were so many of his inventions and innovations in one package. He said to Jobs, "You left out the most important part. Where's the network?" Jobs replied, "You don't need a network. Everything you need is right here." Engelbart replied, "This is like an exotic office with no door and no phone."
But then in the 70s, when a lot of this was blossoming, we really had quite a bit more capability even in there. The prevailing picture of interactive computers was it's for automating your office. And that was just counter to what we were saying is augmenting, where, hey, accept the fact that if you learn new skills and all of that, you can really harness this. No, it was supposed to come in and automate the kind of things you used to do. So that paradigm just killed us. And you say, well, it put the world back quite a few years before something like the web could get a chance to sprout and show them. But
Douglas Engelbart's ideas faced challenges and lost all support in 1977 when artificial intelligence proponents believed that computers would soon become smart enough to understand human needs without the need for people to acquire additional skills. Despite this setback, Engelbart's team continued to support the development of technologies like hypermedia and email through the ARPANET. They recognised the importance of these technologies in improving collective knowledge work, but struggled to gain widespread adoption due to perceived complexity and limited understanding of their value. Ultimately, Steve Jobs' vision of a standalone personal computer that never connected to anything else stopped the last remaining support for Engelbart's vision of collaborative work over network computers. He was unable to get funding for anything. Logitech, which made a very large amount of money from Engelbart's invention of the computer mouse, gave him permanent office space. Engelbart and his daughter established the Bootstrap Institute to promote the vision of enhancing collective knowledge work in society. They emphasised the need to recognise the importance of collective intelligence and the challenges faced by organisations in adapting to rapid technological advancements. They called for a strategic approach to develop the necessary infrastructure and capabilities to effectively harness technology for collective problem solving.
The term we've started using in the last 6-8 years is calling collective IQ, and that's saying many things can improve in your society, but that's one that if we really get going on can help us cope with a lot of the other issues which are already serious, and which issues are likely to get even more serious as the rest of this digital revolution happens and everything changes in disorder.
They believed that governments and organizations should invest in strengthening their improvement infrastructure, fostering improvement communities, and leveraging technology to enhance collective knowledge work. the Bootstrap Institute became the Douglas Engelbart Institute. There are still aspects of his vision that haven't yet been fully realised. Here's a few key areas where his ideas have yet to be implemented. Dynamic knowledge repositories. Engelbart envisioned systems that would organise and retrieve information in a dynamic and contextual manner, allowing users to access relevant knowledge quickly. While we've made significant progress in information retrieval and search engines, the challenge of effectively managing and presenting vast amounts of information in real-time context remains. Part of the problem is that companies like Google have an incentive to corrupt their search engines for pay, and the websites they use for information go down, go out of business, or change their business model like Twitter and Reddit to block access to previous information. Using large language models risks that much of the stuff you search ends up with made-up results, and you have to take time to go and check the facts using a search engine, which defeats the purpose. We need a better system. Collaborative tools. Engelbart emphasised the importance of collaboration and collective intelligence. While we have seen advancements in collaborative technologies, such as online document editing and video conferencing, there's still room for improvement in creating seamless and intuitive collaborative tools that enhance teamwork and creativity. Augmentation of creativity. Engelbart believed that computers could enhance human creativity by providing tools and environments that stimulate innovative thinking. While we've seen advancements in creative software tools such as digital art and music production software, and more recently generative AI tools, the full potential of computers in augmenting and amplifying human creativity is yet to be fully realised. Augmenting human cognition. Engelbart's vision extended beyond the augmentation of human intelligence to encompass the augmentation of human cognition, which includes learning, memory, concentration, and attention. We've made strides in developing technologies that enhance specific cognitive functions, such as memory aids and various training apps. The comprehensive augmentation of human cognition through technology remains an ongoing area of exploration and development. Perhaps we'll all have an AI prompting us with ideas or translations or words or new ways of remembering. Or we'll all be wearing head straps with direct current stimulation to our brains. Or just enormously more targeted education and training techniques. Universal accessibility. Engelbart stressed the importance of making technology accessible to everyone, including people with disabilities or without any resources. While progress has been made in accessibility, there's still a lot of work to be done to ensure universal access to technology and bridge the digital divide. In the world today, there's still many people who haven't even had an opportunity to learn arithmetic or to read and write, let alone to have access to public libraries and the internet. Overall, Engelbart's unfinished computer revolution refers to his broader vision of using technology to augment human capabilities. Here's Jeff Rollison, former member of Engelbart's team, speaking in 1998 on the unfinished parts of Douglas Engelbart's vision that many people in Silicon Valley just didn't get.
But there's a much more fundamental thing that Doug was actually onto at that time, which we got, which was somehow if we integrated all of this together the right way, we could get some sort of scaling effect, Moore's Law kind of thing, in our capacity to solve problems, not just in the technology
so
that we make.
A Moore's Law effect on society,
right,
as opposed to a Moore's Law effect on our machines.
Right. And so... You know, if we had a group of 10 people, they have a certain capability, Doug's terms, to do something, then when we got 20 people together in this new kind of environment, rather than having 1.5 times the capability, we'd have 3 times the capability.
He's talking about a human singularity, where humans get better and better at getting better and better, where our problem-solving abilities are constantly improved, and therefore so is everything we do. How many organizations, corporations, and governments have people dedicated to improving their methods and techniques? Replacing paper with electronic paper was a very short-sighted takeaway from Douglas Engelbart's vision.
So there was some superscaling effect in the vision. And I think that's the part that we're still not onto in the revolution.
Overall, Douglas Engelbart didn't completely finish his computer revolution of augmenting human capabilities, improving collective intelligence, and enabling better problem solving in the face of increasing complexity of problems. His work laid the foundation for innovations in computer systems and user interfaces, but his vision remains a work in progress, requiring further efforts to be fully realized. In the 40 years between when he was forced to retire from building his vision from lack of support, surrounded by a $1 trillion industry built on his work, and his retirement in 2008, the US government and Silicon Valley squandered an incredible opportunity to fund his work and see what else he could have created. What new platforms of innovation could have come from his work? What new $100 billion industries might have emerged? It's a truly tragic loss. Douglas Engelbart died in 2013, but he lived long enough to see his impact on contemporary computing and the reintroduction of network computing, the development of the World Wide Web and network services over the internet for the public. In the end, Douglas Engelbart achieved his main goal. He maximized his contribution to mankind. It's our job now to continue to implement his vision of augmenting human intelligence.
And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please subscribe to the Diffusion Science Radio channel on youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. And rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including Radio Blue Mountains 89.1 FM in New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and 2XXFM in Canberra. Diffusion is narrowcast on Indigo FM 88 in northeast Victoria. Diffusion is syndicated globally on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. And check the website for links, photos, and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 1,000 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labeled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf or join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.